Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. North Korea's participation in the Winter Olympics in South Korea continues to receive widespread international media attention, especially after athletes from both countries wore the same uniform and carried a unified flag during the opening ceremonies. In a recent New York Times op-ed, today's guest, journalist and author Suki Kim, criticizes media coverage of North Korea's participation in the Winter Olympics, especially the way they've reported on the women who are deployed abroad by the North Korea regime when it wants to show its best face to the world. In 2011, Suki Kim went undercover in North Korea, posing as a missionary and an English teacher. She writes about her experience in the New York Times bestseller, Without You, There Is No Us, Undercover Among the Sons of North Korea's Elite. Suki Kim has been to North Korea 5 times. Hi, Suki. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you, Suki. I think a lot of people have been watching what's going on at the Olympics and have been taken by what they've seen, especially at the opening ceremonies, with athletes from both countries coming together, wearing the same outfit, carrying a unified flag. You've been interviewed in a couple of outlets. You told Reuters that the world's media has been complicit as far as making it all seem charming. In plain words, you said, it's propaganda. Can you talk about that? Talk about what you think about the overall coverage and why you think it's propaganda.
Well, because this is just what North Korea does. It's a land of propaganda. The special focus has been this time around on women, young, attractive women. And it's really a disturbing thing. I mean, it's not surprising that North Korea does that because it's always done that. But for the world to find it like charming or attractive, and basically the entire coverage on the Olympic is the main curiosity is these women. And I mean, that has sort of a zero relevance to actual state of things, which is that North Korea is the biggest Gulag nation, and they just 5 months ago conducted a nuclear test, and it's considered one of the world's greatest threats. So this overnight attitude shift, not from North Korea, but from the world, is what's really disturbing. And that's basically a definition of propaganda.
Hmm. The other thing that's getting a lot of attention is Mike Pence refusing to stand and, quote, snubbing the North Korean leader's sister, Kim Yo-jong. He said in some reports, I didn't avoid her, I ignored her. And, you know, if you're just getting glimpses of media, you saw videos and photos of people around Mike Pence in the box standing and clapping, and Mike Pence and his wife did not stand and clap. What are your thoughts about the media's focus on that and what Mike Pence did or didn't do?
But, you know, that's also propaganda. I mean, what's propaganda? It's basically showing a false face for some political maneuvering and manipulation, which really has nothing to do with the substance. That's what it is, isn't it? And you know, U.S. right away turned around. Pence basically turned around from the event saying that, you know, the U.S. probably will engage in talks, ready to engage in talks with North Korea. So actual political message has nothing to do with these photo op moments, exactly the same as when the two Korean athletes marched together at the opening ceremony. That also has nothing to do with the reality. Korea, for 75 years, citizens could not meet, ever, not even a phone call, not even a letter, unless it's for the photo op moment of those families that you see meeting on my cover of paper.
Suki, I think a lot of people don't know much, obviously, about North Korea, but they also don't really know about the history of Korea. I have a friend who's from South Korea, and she said, you know, we have a problem when people say North Korea and South Korea, but the real problem is that most people have no idea about the history. So what are your thoughts on that? I mean, when you have a couple of pages to write an article or 5 minutes to do a radio piece, what do you think reporters should include to give people some context?
I mean, I think that it's, you know, right now, somehow there's an amnesia, right? Like, it's as if this sort of curiosity of the pretty women on screen is some sort of, it's camera worthy for the world. Why? Because it's curious. And first of all, I mean, something like cheerleaders that they've been going crazy over. they're not cheerleaders, because we consider cheerleaders from our definition. Cheerleaders are voluntary, or voluntary, they're usually a hobby, or you do it for money, right? Professional cheerleaders. And when you have this set of women that have nothing to do with voluntary presence, they've been sent over by the regime, clearly that's actually not a cheerleader. It's citizens that's been rounded up to look pretty for a political gain by the world's biggest gulag. So I think basically almost like a starting point is different. And I think that the fact that this country is a completely different from basically any other country in the world. It's been locked away for 75 years. And I think somehow that is missing. Like, even in an Olympic coverage, when you think about it, what is Olympics? It's about the world coming together in harmony, right? But North Korea citizens are not allowed to leave, and no one really can go in without the regime sanction. So it's the one country that will not participate in the world whatsoever, that forbids its citizens from leaving its border. And that's like the opposite of what Olympics is. So like that main message is missing somehow. And then you just give these photographs of pretty girls cheering, and it gives a completely wrong message of what's really going on.
In your New York Times piece, you report that these women are actually deployed abroad by the North Korea regime when it wants to show its best face to the world. So this is pretty common?
There are other instances. You know, when I was there, well, first of all, there's, you know, one thing people see a lot is those North Korean restaurants that are abroad. If you go to, like, China, there's, you know, many in the border area or Cambodia or these countries that have relations with North Korea. And those women are considered, like, there are waitresses, but they're not waitresses. They're young women that are there for about 3-year exchange, sort of a diplomatic mission. And what they do is sort of pour drinks and sing and dance and also do waitressing. And it's considered a diplomatic position. And the regime does this. They round up sort of like girls from upper class, and then also pretty, very similarly to these cheerleaders, and then they deploy them to raise cash. So that would be one example. And even when I was in North Korea, my students were, you know, one day rounded up. You know, it was never explained to us where they were sent, but, you know, they had to all go somewhere, usually as a backdrop. You know, probably the guess was that there was a foreign dignitary, and they had to have Pyongyang's best students, sort of almost a backdrop. So the way the citizens are rounded up is pretty common. So, I mean, for this moment, to be calling them cheerleader is almost, I mean, it's beyond naive, because it's actually complicit to what North Korea wants, you know, which is legitimizing itself to the world.
Suki, you were born in South Korea. You moved to the United States at age 13. In 2002, you made your first visit to North Korea to write about the 60th birthday celebration of Kim Jong-il.
Today.
Before we talk about your experiences, because they're really incredible, I mean, you're one of the only journalists, or if not the only journalist, that has been undercover in North Korea, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What is it like? We'll talk about being undercover, but a lot of journalists, or some journalists, go to North Korea on these state-sponsored trips. What are those trips like?
I mean, what the trips are not different from what you're seeing at the Olympics in a way. You know, basically, it's all designed, handpicked for you. But in a land of propaganda, in North Korea, you know, you will be seeing like 3 or 5 things. And those concerts, you know, the North Korean concert they just did in South Korea, you see an equivalent of that, of this best, you know, looking women yet again performing for you or something. So basically it's almost like going on a Disney tour. You know, if you were to go to Disney World and you see a tour that's all been programmed. So if that's all you see, and the people that you supposedly interview are handpicked by the regime, like, What journalism is there? You know, that's what I found. It was impossible to really see the inside of North Korea entirely. And you also know, on top of that, if you are to print what you just saw, which is programmed by the North Korean regime, then you've just done a press release. for that regime. Mm-hmm. So complicity is a very big part of covering North Korea, which is why it's very difficult. And in some way, I guess, we have bad journalism all the time, but in this case, the cost is higher because you have 25 million citizens who've been stuck in that country who are, you know, it's considered the world's biggest gulag by the United Nations. And, you know, you're also writing up stuff that the regime basically feeds you. And I mean, I really don't know if that's what journalism is. And I think, you know, it's an utter failure, really.
Human Rights Watch came out with a report in 2015, and it says that a UN Commission of Inquiry found that abuses in North Korea were without parallel in the contemporary world. They include extermination, murder, enslavement, torture, rape, forced abortions, other sexual violence. According to this report, North Korea operates secretive prison camps where perceived opponents of the government are sent to face torture and abuse, starvation rations, and forced labor. How does a group like Human Rights Watch get information about these horrors?
I mean, they have multiple. I mean, nothing in North Korea is ultimately verifiable. But, you know, you do have statistics from interviewing not few, but just endless amount of defectors from all different circumstances. Mm-hmm. And also, we do have programs like World Food Program that, you know, can put people into North Korea to see the, you know, level of famine that's going on. And so I think that from multiple sources that you can get some idea of what's going on in that country. You know, I followed when I went in repeatedly for a decade. I also interviewed a ton of defectors through that time, and just to try to understand from every single angle that I could, you know, spending time with human traffickers in the border, and I'm fluent in the language. And so, you know, it still took me, I think, a decade for me to feel like I sort of understood what's happening here as much as I can. And, you know, the level of violations was unbelievable. I mean, there was zero freedom. The students I lived with that really got to know and learned to love, you know, were reared completely differently. We're not allowed to do anything. I mean, right now when I'm watching the coverage, it's actually astounding to me. Even the South Korean media is talking about the fact that today is a Lunar New Year, and they're talking about these cheerleaders and how they will celebrate the Lunar New Year. I mean, North Korean celebration is very different. You know, what's more important for them right now is the fact it's Kim Jong-il's birthday. Kim Jong-il died in 2011. Their former great leader's birthday is bigger than the New Year celebration for North Koreans. And it's kind of shocking that the South Korean media doesn't point that out. You know, it's like how, because I guess that what I'm talking about is that the media, we are only looking at it from our point of view. Mm. You know, for South Korean media, Lunar New Year, it's the biggest holiday of the year right now in South Korea. So that's what they think is also important for North Koreans. Not really, because North Koreans have operated totally differently for 75 years, where their biggest holiday is actually the birthday of the great leader, even if he's dead. And I think that when you think about the consequences of that psychology, it's a totally a different way of thinking, you know. And I think that's why media keeps getting it wrong. Even someone like Kim Yo-jong, who is Kim Jong-un's sister, who just came for a visit for a few days, you know, media's perception was they couldn't believe how refined she looked. You know, she was attractive, she's young, she's the, you know, I guess the media has been calling her, you know, North Korean Ivanka Trump. I mean, in reality, you know, Kim Yo-jong is a part of a family that's basically held North Korean family hostage for 75 years. She was born into the biggest luxury in that, in the only luxury in that nation. Like, why wouldn't she look refined? You know, like, Mrs. Gather, she was brought with the best of best in North Korea, the only one, really, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, even I was even taken by a New York Times piece that wrote about her, and they quoted a number of South Koreans at the Olympics who traveled hours to get there. And they said, you know, some of them said they've never seen someone from North Korea, and they were so shocked at how she looked, and they were describing her clothing. I mean, it's exactly what you wrote about in the op-ed. And that was piece.
Yeah, South Koreans, they, you know, their understanding of North Korea at this point are defectors. And defectors are a particular group. Those are, you know, usually the bottom class. They're people from the border. North Korea also has no travel allowed within the country. You have a checkpost between each town What that means is people are not traveling. There's no movement within the country. So defectors usually come from the border area. You know, usually the bottom class, the border area people, border with China, I mean. So, you know, that's a completely different class of people. North Korea is incredibly class divided also. Mm. So that's almost a different class of people who have now, you know, escaped into China, and a very few of them make their way to South Korea. There's about 30,000 of them. And South Koreans are very familiar with them at this point because a lot of them are featured on their television, reality TV shows, and et cetera. That population has zero to do with Kim Yo-jong. Kim Yo-jong is basically North Korea's only, you know, the highest class in a way, which in that country is actually the biggest dictator and the most murderous family in the world history. So I think to compare that's a North Korea that they're curious to see is completely misleading, because Kim Yo-jong is a completely different case.
Today we're speaking with journalist and author Suki Kim. In 2011, she went undercover in North Korea, posing as a missionary and an English teacher. She has been to North Korea 5 times. She wrote about her experience in the New York Times bestselling book, Without You, There Is No Us, Undercover Among the Sons of North Korea's Elite. She's also written for a number of publications. And if you have any questions or comments for Suki Kim about North Korea, and what did you think of the coverage of the Olympics and the North and the South coming together? And what about the saber rattling between North Korea and the White House? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment on social media. Suki will be with us for about 8 more minutes. Suki, let's talk about your experience in North Korea. You talk about different classes. And what's really amazing about the time you spent undercover in North Korea in 2011 is that you were teaching and training the sons, these were all boys, of high-level officers of the North Korean regime. This was at the best university in Pyongyang, University of Science and Technology. And you were there in 2011. How did you, get that gig?
Well, I pursued that group, which was an evangelical Christian fundamental group that was international group that was going into North Korea to set up this new university. What's really interesting is that year was their year 100, because they count the year differently from the rest of the world. So that was actually from the birth of the original great leader is how they count their year. So to celebrate year 100, they also did the thing that right now when I said they round up citizens according to whatever the government wants. That year, they shut down every university in the whole country and put all university students into construction field for an entire year. And the only exceptions they made were hand-picked elite students from the country's best university, like Kim Il-sung University and Kim Chaek. These are basically Harvard and MIT equivalent. And they put those, they selected 270 of them and then plucked them out of their existing colleges and put them in this new fancy school funded by evangelical Christians. So, you know, that's an example of how they can just suddenly order their citizens around for whatever they want, much the way these young women have been selected and sent to South Korea during the Olympics. So, you know, that's the time that I ended up living with those 270 young men who, obviously, if they're the only ones hanging out, playing basketball, learning English, while the rest of the country's same age youth, they were age 20 and 19, were all doing manual labor in construction fields. The young men I lived with were absolute creme de la creme of that country.
How often is it for evangelical groups to go to North Korea, and what do they do there?
Well, there's actually, when you go to the border area in China, a lot of aid groups, I would say most of them, are religion-based, generally Christianity. Evangelicals go into North Korea, and they set up, you know, different humanitarian works. You know, I am mixed about that. I don't think that, I just think any help is just so needed when it comes to North Korea. Except, you know, there is a very dodgy, you know, dubious part about, you know, because North Koreans are a very vulnerable population. And when you interview defectors, most of them are devout Christians because they really convert their faith, their devoutness for their great leader to Jesus really fast. And So they are really the ones that, you know, will be converted if evangelicals come in. So the fact why evangelicals target North Korea is not that surprising, because this really, you know, if North Korea falls one day, you know, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if that country just suddenly just falls for another, you know, object of worship. So, I mean, that's not surprising what they do. So they have these businesses. In this case, the university, they decided to, you know, they pay for everything. They build a school and pay absolutely everything to educate them. And North Korea really doesn't care if you are a Christian or Muslim or atheist. You know, someone wants to come in and give you everything for free. Mm. The evangelicals basically, though, have made a pact with the North Korean regime to pretend not to be Christians, because religion is forbidden in North Korea. The really dodgy part about that is also, like, what else are you compromising? They claim they don't hand over any money to the regime, but there's no way you can operate in North Korea like that without handing over money to the North Korean regime.
Suku, we'd love to have you back to talk more about your book. I should say that you, in your book, you write that three times a day, the students you worked with had to sing praises to Kim Jong-il, saying, "Without you, there is no motherland. Without you, there is no us." And that's where the title of your book comes from, "Without You, There Is No Us, Undercover Among the Sons of North Korea's Elite." We have just a couple minutes left. Suki, why do you think the North Koreans and the South Koreans came together for the Olympics?
Well, I mean, it's you know, this is a moment that was needed politically. You know, the whole Kim Jong-un and Trump banter had gone out of control. I mean, there was no way what was going to be the next step. North Korea always does that. They threaten, and then they do a turnaround. Also, most of all, is Moon Jae-in, South Korean president. His entire platform is on pro-engagement policy. So that's, you know, I mean, I would love to point that as some sort of humanitarian goal, but more than that, this is his political agenda. You know, that's how he rose to power. So, you know, this is, if his entire policy is based on that, then, you know, he was going to angle towards dialogue with North Korea. He said it from the moment he stepped into office. So, you know, between America and South Korea, and also what North Korea needed at the time, you know, this is what was going to happen. So Olympic was a perfect opportunity to present to the world that the Koreas are talking again. So in a way, there's nothing surprising about that. You know, this scenario of unbelievable tension followed by some sort of a peaceful-looking talk has been going on the entire time.
And
you know, also, 10 years ago, I covered a New York Philharmonic concert. I don't know if anybody remembers that. That was very similar thing, where the world went crazy over how music has changed North Korea. New York Philharmonic went and played a concert in Pyongyang, much the way the Olympic ceremony has been played out. And, you know, that did nothing. But that was also used to pretend as if, you know, everything was okay.
Right.
And that diplomacy moment did nothing.
I remember that. I also wanted to ask you, how serious are you taking the saber rattling? The New York Times has a piece which ran a couple weeks ago, and I just want to read the first two graphs. The White House has grown frustrated in recent weeks by what it considers the Pentagon's reluctance to provide Trump with options for a military strike against North Korea, according to officials. The National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, believes that for Trump's warnings to North Korea to be credible, the United States must have well-developed military plans. This got a lot of attention in the media. What do you make of it, Suki? I mean, the Pentagon, according to these officials, is worried that the White House is moving too hastily toward military action.
I mean, I think it is worrying. I mean, I think that those are, I mean, this is, you know, because at the same time, North Korea is run by Kim Jong-un, you know, and that's the most worrying part about all of that. In reality, you know, U.S. just said they're open to a dialogue. So it's not, you know, it's translating into real policy changes in any way. But I think those erraticism of this possible military threat that keeps looming is very worrying. I mean, that is new from Americans' point under this administration.
Yeah, it says a lot that the Pentagon is worried that the White House is moving too fast toward military action.
I mean, and I think that's one change that we've seen here. Mm. But at the same time, how much of that is also politically maneuvered here is a whole other question.
Right.
Because we do have a president that's not exceptionally popular, you know, within the administration. So how much of that is maneuvering? I'm not sure.
Suki Kim is an investigative journalist and New York Times bestselling author of Without You, There Is No Us, Undercover Among the Sons of North Korea's Elite. That book is based on the experience she had in 2011 when she went undercover in North Korea, posing as a missionary and an English teacher. Suki has been to North Korea 5 times, and she has written for a number of publications. Suki, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You can find Suki's recent op-ed in the New York Times at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after the break, we'll be joined by Arthur Delaney, senior reporter with the Huffington Post, to talk about the White House budget. We will also talk about the Senate's failure to vote on a bill to protect Dreamers. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email yourcall@klw.org or leave a comment on the website at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, it's 1A, and on Fridays, that means 1A is on at noon as well. At 1, it'll be a roundup of domestic news and international news at noon. Stay with us if you can, here on Local Public Radio, KLW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday's One Planet series, we will rebroadcast a conversation we had about an incredible documentary called Chasing Coral. I hope you can check that out on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. Now I would like to welcome Arthur Delaney to the show. Arthur is a senior reporter with the Huffington Post, and he has been writing about the White House's budget. Hi, Arthur. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you back, Arthur. We wanted to bring you on to talk specifically about the sections of the budget calling for cuts to food stamps. 42 million people in the U.S. use food stamps, and the replacement of monthly benefits with a cardboard box of non-perishable goods. Before we dive into the details, you make a point in your piece that's really important. You write that Congress has control of the budget. Now, it's obviously important to talk about this because it lays out the White House's vision for the country, and the Republicans that are standing next to Trump also support this budget. But can you just talk about the politics behind the budget?
Right. It's important to remember that Congress is actually in charge of all spending levels. So when you see stories about a budget doing this and that, you've got to keep in mind that nothing actually happens just because the budget says that's what they want. It's a statement of priorities of President Trump's and of any president. Presidents are supposed to put out a budget every year. And it can be used to signal where they want to go with policies. I think in this case, some of the stuff in there, they are just kind of spitballing and don't have any intentions to take it seriously. Or it could even be a head fake when their real intention is to go in a different direction. I think with the food stamps part in particular, the headline item about switching people's benefits over to canned goods is not serious at all. But it does give a helpful perspective. It tells you what, you know, sort of which direction they want to go, and it's important to look at because Congress will be taking that program up this year since it's due for a reauthorization.
Just to give people some numbers, as you report, 40 million Americans live in poverty every year. This is according to the U.S. Census. 3.2 million live on less than $1.90 a day every day, according to the World Bank. Now, this is people who live in the United States. 42 million people use food stamps. You know, the other thing that rarely comes up, Arthur, when the media talk about things like Social Security or food stamps is, you know, how much money are we talking here? 42 million people, as you report, receive a food voucher averaging $125 per person every month. That is not a lot of money. That does not go very far when you're talking about buying, you know, healthy food, especially.
That's right. For individual food stamp recipients, it's about $125 per person, which is not a lot of money. You can't really get an entire food budget on that, but you're not supposed to. It's supposed to supplement, so that's important to remember. The program itself costs about $70 to $80 billion a year. You know, that sounds like a lot, but in the grand scheme of federal budget, it's like 1% of all federal spending. So while it is one of the biggest safety net programs we've got, it's pretty small in the grand scheme of things when you're spending $500 billion annually on defense alone.
Exactly. And this money actually goes right back into the economy because people can redeem the food stamps, $125 a month, at almost any major grocery store, and also you can go to farmers markets.
Absolutely. So you get that money deposited onto a debit card monthly, and then you spend it, so it benefits the merchants who are in your neighborhood. I think the biggest companies that get the most out of food stamps are actually places like Walmart, but it's also farmers markets, which in some states there's an actual boost for money spent on things like fresh produce. So it's a pretty significant part of the economy. And that's a one weird thing about the Trump administration's proposal to switch it over to canned goods that the government buys wholesale is it would take away that whole part of the process where people get to act like they're equal members of society in terms of their grocery budgets, and that benefit flows to retailers. The Trump administration and this thing that they sort of made up the night before they put the budget out completely cuts that out, which was a big surprise.
And as you said, Congress controls federal spending, but the fact is this budget goes after the most vulnerable people, people on Medicaid, people on Social Security, people receiving food stamps. And a lot of people are on edge wondering, are these benefits going to be cut? So what part of this budget, especially on food stamps, let's say, should we take most seriously? What could be cut?
On food stamps, what they're actually looking to do is more modest than the big 25% reduction that's gotten most of the headlines this week. They want time limits on able-bodied adults, people who don't have disabilities, who receive benefits. There are already time limits, which they call work requirements, but what they would do is make them stricter, make them apply to older people, make them apply to people with children. And that's something that conservative members of Congress have said is a priority for them this year, and it's something that Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, has also said is a priority for him. At the same time, though, that's controversial stuff, and it's not clear that the leader in the Senate is willing to go along with it. So we've got to keep our eye on it, but I wouldn't fret that it's about to happen.
This does send a message, though, to the country. It shapes people's opinions of food stamp recipients, Medicaid recipients. What struck you about the media coverage of that this week and just the messaging that you're hearing from these Republicans?
I think that the media does a decent job of covering the budget and describing what it does, but at the same time making clear that it's a symbolic document and that it's really Congress that is in charge. Now, the symbolism itself is usually not examined as closely, but it's important as well. One way to think about it is we did a poll a few weeks ago that asked survey respondents, when they hear about a specific program, do they think it's more white people or African Americans? And a lot of people thought that for any given program, it was mostly African Americans receiving benefits from whether you called it welfare or food stamps or public housing. And that's not true. African Americans are a minority in this country, and they are not the lion's share of benefits recipients for really any program. But that's what people think when they hear about these programs. So when there's a messaging document that says we're going to cut food stamps, we're going to cut public housing, you have to think about who is the intended audience for this, and what are people supposed to think. And it's especially noteworthy with a president who's been a huge race baiter through his entire political career.
And you've been writing about this. In 2015, you cited data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which administers this program. You report 40% of SNAP recipients, food stamp recipients, are white, 25% black, 10% Hispanic. What about how this program has changed over time and what we have seen under different administrations? What stands out for you there?
Over the course of the program's history, it's gotten more generous and more efficient. You know, it used to be you actually had to buy stamps and then redeem them at a supermarket, and that was a huge hassle. Now that it's at electronic benefits, it's much simpler, and that's been a huge gain. It's weird that the Trump administration said, well, we'll actually just ship everyone canned goods, and that this will save us a ton of money, and people will think it's like Blue Apron. That's not true at all. Another change that we've seen over the last decade is that more and more SNAP recipients, it's called the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, so we call them SNAP recipients, more people are working, and that partly reflects work requirements in the program, but it also just reflects the nature of work. There are more jobs that pay so little that you can still qualify for a program for poor people. That's a trend that's been going on for 30 years, and it's a really important thing to know about the way our country is shaped.
It's a very important, especially as Republican legislatures are backing bills that would require food stamp recipients to work. In fact, the Wisconsin Assembly just approved a welfare overhaul package championed by Governor Scott Walker. It had no Democratic support, and it increases work requirements for food stamp recipients in Wisconsin.
Right. Well, they call it a work requirement. If there's no job available, then you're just kicked off after a certain amount of time. I think it's a little more accurate to say it's a time limit on people who are unemployed. Wisconsin, in some ways, is a little bit better than other states in that they do provide job training slots that can meet these requirements. In most states, though, when there's a work requirement, there's no allowance made for whether suitable work is actually available for a given beneficiary. It's basically a way to kick people off benefits and then blame them for not having gotten the job.
You know, and this is just really cruel, Arthur, because as you write, the box proposal is based on the Commodity Supplemental Food Program, which distributes monthly boxes of food to about 600,000 seniors across the country. And I've seen these boxes. I mean, at a community center, they'll have like 100 boxes. People will wait outside in line to get these boxes. There's a block of cheese. There's like a generic can of green beans. You know, a lot of food that is not fresh, and some of it is, when you're talking about, is it healthy? That's very questionable. I mean, a block of cheese, when did it expire? All kinds of questions around this.
Yeah, so there's been a longstanding concern that people on food stamps don't have good diets. The data shows that their diets aren't really any worse than the average American diet, but people have looked at ways to maybe, you know, give extra funds for farmers markets, which is a program running in a few places. And then out of nowhere, the Trump administration said, well, we'll just give people rice and beans in boxes, and that'll help with their nutrition. But this was so carelessly done. Honestly, you can't even say that the stuff that goes in these boxes is going to be healthy for most people if it's like a bunch of starchy stuff like rice and pasta and beans. They made very little effort to make this seem like a reasonable thing, that the boxes don't contain any fresh produce. Nobody had ever heard of this idea, furthermore. And then they said it would be like Blue Apron, which is a gourmet meal delivery service that'll send you, like, what you need for an individual luxury meal that you make yourself, and you'll get, like, an egg and a thimble full of spices, and it will be just delicious. It's nothing like that at all, what they've proposed to do with food stamps. And they know it, and they don't really care.
Joseph Sandberg, a founding investor in Blue Apron, has a piece in The Nation. He says, "Let me tell you, Trump's harvest box is no Blue Apron. The boxes are the epitome of hypocrisy for a party that spent 8 years howling with rage about a first lady who just wanted school lunches to include more vegetables." Today, we're joined by Arthur Delaney, senior reporter with The Huffington Post, talking about the White House budget, specifically how it would affect food stamps at a time when 42 million people use food stamps, and they get what looks like a debit card, $125 a month. And yes, they can go to the grocery store, farmers markets, buy healthy foods, organic foods. But how much can you really buy on $125? Unfortunately, not that much right now. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's hear from Stephen calling from the Alameda County Community Food Bank. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me, and thanks for addressing this topic today. I really appreciate the information that you guys are putting out this morning. SNAP, also known as CalFresh, is one of the most important anti-poverty programs in the country, and only Social Security and refundable tax credits keep more people out of poverty. Without this safety net, actually, poverty would be 4.5% higher in the Bay Area. And then despite this, our government keeps attempting to cut SNAP in order to pay for tax breaks. So here in Alameda County alone, over 112,000 people rely on CalFresh to feed their families. And proposals to cut more than $200 billion over a decade from the program would only make the lines for food at our member agencies all over the county much longer. So, you know, we're always looking for additional voices to support the advocacy work that we do to defend the safety net. And I hope people would consider going to our website at accfb.org and sign up to join our advocacy work to fight for SNAP and SSI, fight hunger and poverty.
Stephen, I appreciate you calling in. 112,000 food stamp recipients just in Alameda County. I mean, that's a huge number. California.
That's only 63% of those who are eligible. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, wow. So a lot of people are eligible but don't get the benefits.
Exactly.
California has the highest poverty rate in the country. We live in an incredibly wealthy state, but nearly one out of five residents is low income or poor. Just quickly, Stephen, what changes have you seen over the years? Because there's been some very good reporting about how in Marin County, another a very wealthy county, has seen a drastic increase in the number of people who are requesting and using food stamps.
Right. Well, you know, there's so many complicated issues that are roiling the East Bay and Bay Area and state economy, gentrification and housing costs. You know, to focus on SNAP, what people may not realize is that the economy improves and people find more jobs and better jobs and maybe even get some raises in their existing jobs, then they don't qualify for SNAP anymore, and the percentage of people on the program has been falling for years. So there's really actually no need to cut the program. If you want fewer people to be on SNAP in this country, then, you know, we need a strong economy that pays a living wage, and then people can afford to buy their own food.
And so, just, we only have about 30 seconds. Stephen, what about the state? What kind of support do you get from state officials?
We have a lot of our policy work is focused on Sacramento, and we are advocating for restoration of cuts to the SSI program. People on SSI are not eligible for SNAP. In California, one of the only states in the nation where that's true. A lot of those 1.3 million Californians are on that program, and we are advocating this year for restoration of the cuts that were made 9 years ago, which the governor has never restored. So the state has been looking for ways to step in and fill gaps that are created by the terrible policy atmosphere we're facing in Washington.
Wow. Well, you know, we need to do a show about this. Thank you for calling in, Stephen. Thank you for your work. That is Stephen calling from the Alameda County Community Food Bank. And today we're joined, it's our media roundtable, by Arthur Delaney, senior reporter with the Huffington Post. Arthur, we've got about 5 minutes left, and I want to bring in a couple other pieces of very important news today. Front cover of today's Chronicle, nearly 700,000 Dreamers remain in limbo. I just want to read from a piece by Carolyn Lockhead. Hundreds of thousands of young undocumented immigrants who came to the U.S. as minors moved a step closer to potential deportation on Thursday as the Senate rejected three measures that would have granted them legal status. The Senate has no scheduled actions today. With the President's Day recess set for next week, senators are unlikely to return until February 26th, 1 week before the expiration of the Obama administration program that protected nearly 700,000 undocumented youth from potential deportation. We've done a lot of shows about this over the last couple months, Arthur, and I can't imagine what the Dreamers, actually I can, they're living in fear, they're really angry, they have no idea what's coming. What are your thoughts about the coverage of this? It's getting a lot of attention.
Well, it's going to shake out over the next few days because it was just yesterday that the Senate had its votes on various bills, and there's an effort by Republicans to make it seem like Democrats just wouldn't take yes for an answer. I think that's not really a fair description of what happened. You have to remember that Donald Trump himself set the deadline for this by rescinding the DACA program. There's been a court decision that could prevent or delay some of these deportations that are supposed to happen, but there's no doubt that DACA recipients and Dreamers are totally being left hanging right now. And it seems like no one knows what's going to happen next. A lot of people think that nothing is going to happen next and that we'll carry on with the deportations as policy would seem to indicate we're supposed to do, and that's that. It'll just be a blame game at this point.
I mean, you have, McClatchy had a really interesting story about how Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican, is going after the White House over this. He is pointing the blame to Stephen Miller, who, I mean, people say that Stephen Miller is xenophobic, racist, very anti-immigrant. Senator Graham said Stephen Miller is an outlier on immigration. He's an extremist. And the president who has turned the keys of the car over to him will never get anywhere. What do you make of this?
This all started yesterday so there were four different things voted on in the Senate. And one of them was a bipartisan bill crafted by a group of senators calling themselves the Common Sense Caucus, and it ultimately received the most votes of any of the proposals, though it still failed. And the White House was fulminating against it all day. There was a statement from DHS. There was then a press call with an anonymous White House official. I wasn't on the call, so I couldn't tell you if it was Stephen Miller. But that's who most people who are following this believe is basically behind the invective toward immigration that the White House has been spewing. And Lindsey Graham is one of those Common Sense Caucus guys, and it's not the first time he's said Stephen Miller is really screwing up this whole process. Because Trump himself has repeatedly said, I want a deal, I'd love a deal. And then every time a deal is presented to him, he says, actually, I don't like it. And so what Senator Graham is saying is that he thinks that's basically because Stephen Miller is whispering in his ear.
David Leonhardt, New York Times op-ed columnist, has a piece that says it all, Trump to Dreamers, get out.
That's our policy right now.
I mean, that's it. I mean, do you really think that they will try to deport these young people?
Absolutely. There's no reason. I mean, that's the law. I guess the only thing that makes it a little less certain is the fact that there's an ongoing legal dispute and an injunction placed on Trump's rescinding of the program. I don't know whether Immigration and Customs Enforcement will abide that. I think that agency has shown that it's got a lot of eager beavers who are willing to go and round people up. And pending that court case, that's our policy, is to deport people who are here illegally. And Dreamers are losing their legal protected status.
Well, Dreamers are going to be out on the streets for sure over the coming days. Democracy Now! Reported that there's going to be a march to Washington over the weekend. I mean, we're going to see a lot of activity from Dreamers in the coming days. What are you hearing, Arthur?
Oh, I would certainly expect to hear a lot from organizations like United We Dream. I mean, these are people who signed up for a government program. It was deferred action. You know, it was something that was supposed to be temporary so that Congress could figure out a more permanent solution. Everybody in politics said that they favored a more permanent solution. And what's basically happening right now is a slow-motion betrayal. And a lot of these Dreamers have been incredibly brave, putting their faces in news stories, even though they are going to be vulnerable to deportation. It's entirely possible that by drawing attention to themselves, they'll draw the attention of ICE.
Right. And while they're doing this, they're studying, they are working, they are supporting their families in some cases, and now they are putting their faces out there, traveling to D.C. This is going to get a lot of attention over the weekend and in the coming days, and you know what the media does. They like to play the horse race. Trump is blaming it on the Democrats. The Democrats are blaming the Republicans. What do you think, Arthur, should be the factual line that we hear in the media?
I think the blame game was a little less clear back when the government shut down for that weekend a few weeks ago, because it was Democrats withholding support. I mean, they could plausibly say at that time that it was something Trump had set in motion, but Republicans were like, the deadline's not for a few weeks. You know, what is the urgency on Democrats' part here? Well, now March is around the corner. The deadline is looming. The Republicans can still say, well, there's a court injunction making this less urgent, but it's pretty clear that Democrats were willing to make all kinds of compromises on the legislation. They were willing to support wall funding, for instance,
right.
And Republicans have rejected these offers. So I think it'll be clear enough that this is something Republicans are doing.
Yeah, this is important. The Collins measure would have included $25 billion for the wall. Feinstein voted for it. Dianne Feinstein, Kamala Harris voted no. So there's a lot of details. I mean, definitely read articles if you want to figure out what exactly went down, because there were something like three different measures.
There were. I thought there were four. And there were. The no votes and the yes votes were both bipartisan, so that makes it difficult suss out, but basically the heart of this one measure that a lot of senators have been trying to put together was bipartisan. The process was supposed to be open. It was something the White House said that, you know, initially we will accept what they come up with, but then the day of the votes, they furiously agitated against the proposals they actually didn't like. It wasn't exactly how the open, freewheeling vote process had been advertised by Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
We are out of time. Arthur Delaney, thank you for joining us. Arthur is senior reporter with the Huffington Post. Thanks to Lauren Schechter for line producing today. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Thanks for joining us.